Welcome to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Before we get started on this week's show, I just want to tell you a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll enjoy some Rebeller originals. Check out S. Craig Zahler's discussion of his favorite graphic novels, or our forthcoming essay by Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin on Sally Menke, the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. We're paying good people good money for the content that you are enjoying right now and also reading on the site, so we hope you'll sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access to everything that we do. It's either $1.99 per month or $20.19 for the whole year. That's a pretty good deal. A savings of 20%. I'm a writer. I don't do math. And now, on to the show. First up is controversies and non-troversies. And guys, you're never going to believe this, but there was outrage on Twitter. There was outrage on Twitter as David Simon, the former journalist and beloved televisual artist behind The Wire and The Deuce, learned that you either die a progressive hero or live long enough to get canceled. In a testy interview with similarly beloved televisual critic Alan Sepinwall, Simon went ham, as the kids say, on those who suggested he and the show's creators were wrong to keep James Franco on staff after allegations emerged that Franco had asked actresses in a class he taught to perform nude, and there was some other stuff, or, you know, whatever. We'll gloss over that. I'll let Alyssa handle that. Simon denounced comparisons to Harvey Weinstein and other predators, saying that Franco never used his power to commit sexual assault or even receive sexual favors. Film and TV Twitter exploded, in large part because David Simon was, let's be a little honest here, just too mean to Alan Sepinwall. And others have suggested that Franco be canceled for what he has done, and Simon is like, he's edging up on that, you know, we got to get rid of him too. But Alyssa, I think he's raising a good point here. If every punishment merits the death penalty, and that is kind of the sense that we are getting from a lot of these discussions, soon you're going to want to stop punishing people altogether. Right?
I definitely want to punish Harvey Weinstein. Sure. I will never stop wanting to punish Harvey Weinstein.
Totally fine. My point here is that calling for nuance in how we treat these subjects is totally reasonable.
I think that's reasonable. I think where Simon got himself in trouble is that he kind of went at it backwards and spent most of his time sort of launching this elaborate defense of Franco instead of doing what he is revered for on his television shows, which was stepping back and taking a look at an entire system. If you articulate a set of standards for how you should judge very different kinds of behavior that fall under the same broad umbrella, you can make a really valuable contribution, right? Because it's the stuff that Franco is accused of, and in some cases is quite serious. He has been accused of and has denied. And this is the thing that sort of set me off the most. Removing the guards that women were wearing during sex scenes and simulating oral sex on them in a way that
got close to actual oral sex.
Yes. Exactly. Again, Franco has denied this. That should be on the record. But that's a pretty serious abuse of power. It's deceptive. It's because it happened in a professional context. It is alleged to have happened in a professional context. You know, it's an abuse of workplace power. And the idea that the allegations against him don't contain any kind of use of power is sort of strange, since the people who have brought these allegations up, in some cases, are students in his acting classes. Mm-hmm. So it is sort of a professional environment.
And not just students, but students who were in acting classes that he explicitly used to cast the many very low budget movies that he makes as a filmmaker himself.
Mm-hmm. So the idea that, I mean, you know, maybe he's not forcibly raping 80 women, as, you know, Harvey Weinstein is accused of, but it's not like this is okay. Mm-hmm. And so I agree that we should preserve the ability to see a distinction between Harvey Weinstein and James Franco. But the most useful way to do that is to sort of set out both, you know, sort of a social and professional sentencing guidelines, effectively, rather than just saying, you know, I know James Franco and he's a good guy. It's it is weird to see, as Linda Holmes from NPR put it on Twitter, someone who is so good at seeing the big picture and how it all fits together and how it creates these gradations in behavior, kind of lose his ability to talk about that non-defensively when it hits home for him.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, he actually reminds me of Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor, you know, defending this guy that they worked with who was accused of rape. And it's very interesting in this movement to see where people's abilities to be critical and to sort of flesh out what's going on kind of break down when it becomes inconvenient for them.
So one of the things he raised, and I think you're onto something there, but at the same time, he actually did describe a kind of systemic and contextual issue. I'm not sure you will agree with it, and I'm not sure even I agree with exactly the way he has characterized it, but it raises a kind of interesting, and or at least I think a useful way of thinking about this stuff that sometimes does get left out, which is he has this line that he goes to a couple of times that's something like, maybe James Franco just doesn't realize what it's like to be James Franco.
Yes.
And what it's like, what kind of attention and what kind of power. And so, look, I can see for listeners here, Alyssa is making a face that says, nope.
Dagger eyes.
And I want to say, on the one hand, James Franco should understand that. But if you're James Franco and you've been James Franco all your life, being a famous person through your 20s, through your 30s,
being very comfortable with your own nudity as well. Right. This is a thing that David
being
Simon discusses.
Being somebody who is adored and worshipped and treated like a, you know, like not the biggest Hollywood star, but in a way that like no one on this podcast understands, that no one, that virtually no one listening really understands
yourself,
what it is,
Suderman.
except for Sonny.
Speak for yourself.
That's Sonny. I treat you. You're my own personal James Franco.
Thank you.
Right. But it's a weird thing to be James Franco is what I'm trying to say. It's unusual. And when you are in that position, you don't always have a nuanced and fine grained understanding of how other people see you and what power that gives you. That is not necessarily an excuse. I'm not saying that makes it okay. What I'm saying is, to the extent we think that's true, what it means is that these people need to be more self-aware about this stuff. And there's a sort of, I sort of feel like in a lot of these discussions, we leave out the fact that it's hard to be. It is hard to be self-aware, especially when the world around you has been built to prevent you from being self-aware, because that would be uncomfortable.
Can I just say, before you answer, Alyssa, there's one other aspect of this to think about, which is that the movie and TV business is weird. And this is a thing that David Simon gets into in this interview, as he says that, look, you know, on the set of The Deuce, we had a whole bunch of things in place to try to avoid these problems. We wanted to make sure everybody was comfortable all the time, and we still messed up. You know, they asked actresses to do slightly more on the sex scenes in certain situations than had been agreed to previously. And their point was, like, we're supposed to go to the agents each time and say, hey, you know, this is what we need your client to do. And instead of doing that, they were going directly to the actresses. And that is unusual for any workplace environment, really. You know, as editors, if you had to go to the agent of every writer who you had to be like, all right, well, I want to ask him to change this comma splice, you know. So it's and obviously these are very big differences, you know, doing sex on camera.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, writing.
Have more sex on camera is a little bit different than
It's different.
Please call the source and get an actual comment.
But you know what actual there is one thing that is actually kind of close to editing, though, that Simon discusses in this piece, where Franco wanted to have a shot of explicit penetrative sex edited in that would have been vintage, not actually shot by any of the actresses or actors, but like they would feel uncomfortable because people would think it was them. So I think it is, we have to remember that it's weird. It's weird.
It's weird. And yet women in Hollywood all of the time are expected to navigate much more crushing expectations than maybe don't sneakily sort of try to have oral sex with somebody. Like, I'm sorry, you know, if every incredibly famous woman in Hollywood has to be aware all of the time of how she is perceived, what sort of power she has or doesn't have, how these negotiations work. Is it really so much to ask men to do that? I mean, it is so exhausting to have as an excuse, like, oh, he just doesn't understand what it's like to be his incredibly famous and powerful self. Like, I would love to live one day without having to think at all about what other people think, but that is not an option that is available to me. It is not an option that will ever be available to me. It is not an option that will ever be available to any woman in Hollywood. And I get it as an explanation, but it is so exhausting and frustrating to hear. I just, you know.
So if we think that's a reason, and maybe I should, one question we should ask is, do we think that that is what it, that partially explains what's going on? And if the answer is no, then what does? And if the answer is yes, then besides just James Franco do better, which is a start to an answer, but I don't think it's a complete one. And James Franco do better is a perfectly fine beginning. What do we do about that problem? Because very wealthy people who are very famous, who are surrounded by professional adorers as well as just fans, right? Like, I mean, this is true even for sort of like minor celebrity writer types, in some ways. Like, there are people who I know who are just journalists who get recognized on the street who, like, it's not that they can't go out to eat, but they can't go out to eat without somebody coming up and saying, "Hey, man, I love your work." And so imagine what that's like when you are,
you know, that only happened,
you know,
that only happened once again, when we were out together,
again,
Peter.
Sonny,
that's not like that happens every time, you know.
Sonny, you are my personal James Franco. I will keep saying it. Right. But like, it's like, just imagine that magnified by 1,000 or 1,000,000, which is what someone like James Franco experiences every day. And it's just such a weird life experience that you can't, I think it's that while I think you can certainly say our expectations for him specifically and people like him should be much, much, much higher. I think you can say that, and that's totally reasonable. It's certainly, some of the stuff he is alleged to have done, if it happened, sounds pretty awful. And I can imagine somebody saying, I don't want to work with this person, either another performer or as a, you know, if you're a producer, if you've got somebody who is taking off protective guards on set, first, like, beyond the right and wrong of it, that's a lawsuit risk. Like, it is wrong, to be clear, but independent of being very wrong, it's a huge lawsuit risk. And so I guess my question is just, like, you're not going to stop James Franco's from being rich and insulated and weirdly, like, up in their own egos, and you're not going to stop them from having really bizarre experiences of what life is like. So how does the world fix the James Franco doesn't understand what it's like to be James Franco problem?
And I guess part of the challenge for me is that I sometimes think that in these circumstances, the solution doesn't have anything to do with the offender at all, right? I mean, Harvey Weinstein derailed the careers of a lot of women, and actually the best thing that you could do for them and for the culture is to find them some of the work that they missed out on for years and give them opportunities that they lost because they wouldn't have sex with this guy in exchange for parts. With James Franco, I would like to see some of those women who made allegations against him, you know, have opportunities to play the kind of parts they want to make the movies they want to make. I, you know, there's this concept of restorative justice, which sounds sort of cheesy when you talk about it, but the idea is that you have to make sort of material or spiritual amends to someone. And, you know, I would like to see the Weinstein Company, like, any proceeds from its transfer or whatever, you know, given to a bunch of people to produce things. Like, I don't know how to solve the James Franco problem because, frankly, I don't know how to solve the patriarchy.
Oh, no.
I know.
Patriarchy.
I know. That's
the
been,
patriarchy.
I feel like you should make me do shots of something terrible every time I say that word.
Here's the real problem here is that you are talking about, in this instance, you're in all of these instances, you're talking about specific people.
Yep.
So what is the punishment that James Franco needs to suffer? So everyone is mad that he was not fired from The Deuce. That is everyone thinks he should have been, the critics of David Simon think that James Franco should have been fired, that his excuses did not meet the level of, you know, apology that were required. And I think it should be noticed that Franco has kind of stopped working. I haven't seen him in much outside of the Deuce in recent years. So,
well, certainly marketing him is going to be a problem.
Right. So what is the actual solution here? Should he have been, do you think he should have been fired from this show for things that happened that did not rise to the level of criminality? I think is fair to argue. The dental dam thing is, you know, hard to say, but does he deserve to lose at least a portion of his livelihood for this stuff?
Again, I'd prefer, I guess if I had to come up with a solution, I'd prefer something where he has to give something back to someone else. And so, I mean, during like the 90s and the early aughts, there were a lot of cases of celebrities who got assigned to kind of make work community service. But, you know, send James Franco to a battered women's shelter and have him spend 500 hours stuffing envelopes, something where someone else is going to be his boss and have, you know, say over whether his image gets rehabilitated and whether his work is good enough, that will actually do some good for some other people in the world. I mean, I think like it's kind of cheesy, and it can also be really tiresome when these folks like this go on some sort of listening tour where the kinds of people who they have harmed are expected to participate in this sort of pageant of their reformation. But yeah, ship him off to a battered women's shelter and have him lick fundraising envelopes for 500 hours.
Let me put this another way, guys. Is David Simon refusing to fire James Franco a controversy or a non-troversy? Peter.
Yes, controversy.
His refusal to fire James Franco is a controversy.
Absolutely, it's a controversy. Okay. I'm not saying I'm not even sure I'd have a strong opinion about what the right thing to do in that circumstance is, but it's a real controversy because people are upset about it, and because it has become an issue that we're still talking about. The original reporting about Franco was in the LA Times in, I believe, January of 2018. It is now late 2019, and this is still something that we are talking about, still something that's making big headlines. Of course, it's a controversy.
It's a controversy, but despite everything I have said so far, I think it's okay for Simon not to have fired Franco.
It's a non-troversy.
Okay, fine. Fine.
On to this week's big release, Terminator Dark Fate. Sarah Connor is back. John Connor is dead. The future was saved, kinda. And Sarah must team up with an augmented human named Grace to save the future savior from a brand new threat. That's right, it's a militarized AI that wants to kill all humans and sent somebody back.
But it's, called Legion. It's different, Sonny.
Sent somebody back into the past to murder the savior of humanity.
You notice how it's just a remake of The Matrix?
What isn't? And also it has Arnold. Everybody loves Arnold. So, Peter, if all we can do is change which AI it is that tries to kill us in the future, do we really have any fate other than the one we make? Or are we just kind of screwed?
Oh, I mean, you know, that's a false choice, Sonny. Ah. That's a false choice.
We choose to screw ourselves.
The retconning here of Skynet into like something as boringly named as Legion.
Legion,
which I think is like several different low budget movies about vampires are called Legion.
Yes, at least one.
I think it's more than that.
A very, very mediocre FX series.
It's really telling how deeply they have screwed up the timeline and the continuity in this franchise, and it kind of is it shows you how badly this franchise has gone after Terminator 2. Is that this is where they finally like ended up? Is 20 years later or whatever, more than that. They finally realize that Linda Hamilton is good and bring her back, and. And decide that, like, all these other movies that we made, every time we tried to reboot or extend this franchise, we're pretty much going to ignore that. And instead, what we're going to do is we're going to Force Awakens this thing and just bring back some of the original stars, turn them into mentors for our young, diverse new cast, and kind of repeat a bunch of the plot beats, but in a sort of remixed way, right? It starts with, like, a big truck chase on a highway where you've got a big truck that drives
through a wall, right?
Terminator
3 did it better,
though. You've got a helicopter sequence at the end of the second act. It's really... I mean, like, It's not terrible, but it has this sort of Force Awakens-y feel of, like, we have done a pretty good job of just remixing the original elements and then repurposing the original cast, and you like them. So Linda
you
Hamilton
like
is just genuinely good, and we should talk a lot about her because she's the best part of this movie. But a big part of why you like this movie and why you like Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger in this film is because you've liked them for 30 years.
Yeah.
It just rests on the fact that you have enjoyed these movies since the middle of the 1980s.
Well, Alyssa, you know, we mentioned the kind of evolution of the male action star last
yeah.
week when we were talking about the first couple Terminator movies. And it is interesting to kind of track the evolution of how masculinity is portrayed, shall we say, by the way the Terminator has kind of evolved over the years. So in the first one, he's essentially a laconic murder machine that mm-hmm. is built like a brick S house, and he's just going out there and he's killing stuff. In the second one, they teach him emotions. He has to learn how to be, kind of in touch with himself. And, I know why it is you cry, that sort of thing. And then in this one, the ideal man is portrayed as sexless. Explicitly, they say he does not have a relationship with the family that the Terminator has for some reason in this movie.
He also has like a window treatments business.
He is sexless and helps with interior decorating.
Right,
that is what the ideal man as portrayed by Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie is.
It's kind of it's kind of a fascinatingly queer movie in certain ways. Like Arnold's character, the interior decorating thing and the sort of like delicacy of the hosting and the sexlessness read as a certain prior era gay stereotype
totally.
In a way that's like kind of fascinating.
Cirque. I mean, it feels like a Cirque movie,
yeah.
A Douglas Cirque.
He also has a lot of guns because this is Texas.
Well, it is Texas.
But it's sort of odd. So about halfway through the movie, I'm sitting next to Peter, and I checked my watch, and I realized that we were an hour and 6 minutes into the movie, and we had not had a really sort of significant male character show up. And I say that, the sort of significant caveat, because you do have Gabriel Luna, who's playing this, like, Lovecraftian Terminator who can, like, pop off of his skeleton and everything.
Well, I mean, it's just the first two Terminators put together. It's the endoskeleton plus the liquid metal alloy.
Plus there can be two of them.
Yeah, and there can be two. And it's
right,
both of them together.
That's the main innovation, is just that the endoskeleton and the exoskeleton can be separated, and there's really no sort of technological difference other than that.
And they explicitly hand wave away all of the technological stuff. Like at one point, Grace, finds where Arnold/Carl is living now, and Linda Hamilton is like, "How'd you do that?" And she's like, "Future shit." And it's like, okay, this is, you're not even trying. You're just messing with us at this point.
But to go back to what I was actually saying, oh my gosh. But it's kind of fascinating to have $185 million action blockbuster where the first hour is just like the Bechdel test, basically. And the three women are pretty good in it. Hamilton, like, absolutely most of all. But it's very interesting that the first half of this movie, yes, there are truck chases and everything else, but it's mostly a three-hander between, these women who are kind of arguing about protective instinct and grief and, family and all of this other stuff. It's sort of strange and wonderful. I don't think the movie as a whole is good, but just seeing something like that was so unusual that it was kind of fascinating.
It's really, it was, you go in expecting one thing and you get something else. It's a real sucker punch, if you will.
In this sense, it is actually not wildly different from the first two movies. And we talked about this on the last episode, is that James Cameron, especially in his 80s films, and that run from the first Terminator through Terminator 2 and even True Lies, was genuinely interested in... especially in Hollywood portrayals of both masculine and feminine virtues, and did some really interesting stuff with that. And so, I thought that was actually an interesting way to develop the ideas that were in the first two films without just repeating them. It is not a repeat of anything like that aspect of it. The weird sort of was lesbian, queer-ish, quasi, but not really like love, not quite triangle. It's like it's the Mackenzie Davis character and the Natalia Reyes character.
It's basically the Lilith Fair of action movies for the first hour, which I love, but not everyone will.
Yes, and like doing that in the Terminator franchise is in keeping with at least with the first two films, and I think that. That aspect of the movie is probably what they pulled off the best.
The first two movies are about sort of how Linda Hamilton's character becomes this heroic badass out of sort of love and protective instinct for, you know, the son that she didn't know she was going to have. And then this movie is about sort of how that has kind of warped her in to a certain extent in some ways, the same ways that we see with a lot of male vigilante characters, right? I mean, she has been reduced to this desire for vengeance. And there's this moment after she re-encounters Arnold and, of course, I'm calling him Arnold instead of Carl.
Carl.
Carl. I mean, Arnold, Carl / T-101. Yeah. They're all the same.
Isn't he technically T-800?
So he was T-800, but in this one, he's a T-101. And I actually don't really understand the difference between the T-800 model
next
Arnold,
week,
and
the
T-101.
But where she, you know... The other two women are kind of inclined to trust him, and she just can't deal. I mean, it's almost as if she's having like a PTSD reaction. And
reasonably.
Yeah.
Because a little bit of spoiler, like the first thing that we see in this movie just about is this model of Terminator coming to kill John Connor. And so it
and succeeding.
Place, right. Yeah. And so
spoilers.
This movie takes place kind of entirely in the shadow of maternal grief.
Yes.
And it is very much in a little bit like Aliens, which you see some of this more in the director's cut, but you was a movie about a woman who lost her child and then gained a kind of adopted new one in the form of Newt and built a little family. And here they build a little family, except it's all women with Carl the Terminator drape guy.
Specifically Carl the sexless Terminator.
Carl the sexless drape guy Terminator as like their house butler or something, right? As like their manservant. He's like their Downton Abbey, like I'm just gonna follow you around and every now and then I'll have to murder some super advanced Terminators. But mostly I'm just here to kind of provide like you need
beer and sandwiches.
Beer and sandwiches, maybe you need some lumber moved around every now and then.
And knowledge. Like one of the weird plot points in this movie is that he is aware that all of these other Terminators are coming and he knows exactly where they're gonna be. So he sends Linda Hamilton text messages and is like, hey, Terminator coming. And it raises a whole host of like tricky time travel questions that
I
don't want us to get bogged down in.
And I actually enjoy the fact that the movie just hand waves them away completely, right? It's like, because it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't really matter. It's just weird if you think about
it. It's not a movie
for more than 10
seconds. No, like Looper, actually, where they're like, you know, we try to explain this. We're going to be sitting here all day long, like, drawing diagrams with straws on napkins. And it's great. It's like, we're not trying to be a movie about the mechanics of time travel. It's just a device that we use to get us into a bunch of weird psychosexual, gender commentary, and very expensive action sequences.
The problem with all this, though, is that there are only so many plots you can do when the only thing that you're really doing is setting in motion one thing by sending a robot into the past to kill someone.
Yeah.
And that's why all of these movies eventually feel the same.
Yes.
And this movie is 100%... a ripoff of all the other ones. It is totally generic. I was deathly bored, despite the fact that everything is very competently done, and it's kind of funny, and it's well acted. But I was just sitting there thinking, okay, why am I here? Why am I watching this? And like, I think the last shot of the movie kind of represents everything that is wrong with it from this perspective. Because if you remember the end of the Terminator. You know, the last shot is Linda Hamilton kind of driving off to her uncertain future with the mountains looming in the foreground and the clouds and and you know, there's a dark future ahead. And instead, on this one, it ends with them driving down a tree-lined street where you can't see anything. You just see trees. And it's like a suburb street. It's like, oh, why? This is the final shot? This is like the thing that you send us out on?
But they're trying to talk about the domestic life that these two women are going to build for themselves, and the peacefulness they're going to bring.
They're preparing for war. I mean, look, again, the whole point of this movie is that the only thing that humanity will end up doing is killing itself with AI machines. Whether you call it Skynet or Legion or Genesis, didn't they already do this with Terminator Genesis? Like, wasn't it the Genesis thing that, like, was Skynet instead?
Genesis was also an attempt to retcon all of the continuity,
right.
And in fact, and was even more of a kind of explicit, like, we're just going to pay homage to the originals, because the first hour of the movie, they literally just revisit scenes from the first two movies. It's like, well, instead of just kind of nodding to them and kind of quasi-remaking them, no, we are going to literally go back, like Back to the Future 2 style, except not nearly so clever, and just have our characters like run around behind, Michael Biehn in the first Terminator on the Hollywood Boulevard or the Sunset Strip set.
Yeah. Starring Emilia Clarke as like a weirdly soft version of Linda Hamilton. Yeah, I was just that whole
everything about that
movie was poorly conceived. This is better.
It's a big step up.
It's better. It's better. It's still not particularly good or necessary. And that's why I give it a thumbs down. I don't know about you guys. Alyssa, what do you say?
It's inessential.
Do people need to go see it or
no,
not?
No. Don't
rush out.
Wait for it to stream. You'll be fine.
I agree with Alyssa. I don't give it a thumbs down. I give it like a thumbs sideways.
Your thumb sideways. I think this is. Didn't you give the movie last week a thumb sideways?
This is my
Laundromat.
First thumbs. I believe this is my first thumb sideways.
Maybe it was a thumbs down. I don't remember.
I think
anyway,
Laundromat was an actual thumbs down.
Okay. We need a spreadsheet.
Yeah, we need that. We need to track this. All right. And that
Sonny,
us,
why don't we have interns?
We need once this hits 50,000 listens, you heard it here first, folks. When we get to 50,000 downloads, we will get a across the movie aisle intern. Halloween has just passed, and one of my favorite Halloween traditions is rewatching The Shining. And I learned that my friend and our valued co-host here, Alyssa Rosenberg, has never seen The Shining, which means that Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece of horror is perfect for assigned viewing this week. Alyssa, did you love it?
I really did, and I did not expect to. I, as listeners of this podcast may know, am an enormous coward when it comes to horror. I really don't enjoy being scared, in part because I have extraordinarily vivid nightmares. I went into The Shining expecting that this was going to be yet another way that Sonny has cooked up to torture me, and instead found myself wanting to do a lot of rug shopping and singing the praises of Shelley Duvall, who is fantastic in this movie. I think you guys would have gotten me to watch it earlier if instead of telling me that it was like a classic horror movie, you had told me that it was about abusive men and fantastic mid-century modern design.
No. It's not about abusive men. It's about men who are failed by their families, who want them to be failures and not succeed at life. And so they go a little bit nuts. I mean, we all go a little nuts sometimes.
Can we agree, though, that it's a movie about the greatness of mid-century interior design?
Sure.
It really is. I mean, I know everyone talks about the hallway rugs, but that rug outside of the gold room is just fantastic.
And this is true of A Clockwork Orange, too, is that it's very much a movie about design and about architecture.
Aesthetics.
And Stanley Kubrick was famously kind of, he's not, like, for a kind of humanist director, he's not all that interested in people. He has a sort of a, there's a coldness and a distance to the way he treats them. He doesn't treat them warmly, I'll say. He's just sort of like, well, people are often horrible. That's interesting.
But I also think that The Shining ended up being a really interesting companion to Terminator Dark Fate. That's
yeah.
what we're
Terminator,
Terminator
Dark Fate.
Dark Fate. Jeez,
Terminator,
I can't even remember
Dark
the name of the movie.
It's destined to be a classic.
Clearly.
Dark Fate-inator.
But it's an interesting counterpart to Terminator Dark Fate, because instead of having this crew of like badass women who team up against this evil man, you know, Shelley Duvall as Wendy she's kind of an emotionally weak person. She is not at all physically imposing. And yet she spends this sort of back half of the movie just fighting for her son, even though it's obviously terrifying and really hard. And she's not necessarily doing that good a job of protecting
him. The way she swings the bat in the staircase scene.
It's so good.
But it's so weak. It's so incredibly, in a way that is specifically designed to get you in some ways to think a little less of her. While also in the end, she knocks. That's the moment that she knocks him down right before she is.
Well, she got some help from the stairs.
That's true, but it's really a kind of telling portrayal. And just this little physical motion. She swings like a girl in the kind of classic sense, and yet even out of that, sort of able to build some strength for her character
and save her son, right? And it's. You know, it's not badass. It's not necessarily even admirable, but it feels very, very human. I mean, that early scene when she's talking to Danny's pediatrician and telling the story of how his arm got dislocated and just making excuses for Jack every step of the way, is, you know, covering him, is nervous about being judged, is, you know, sort of chain smoking. And she just radiates this nervous energy. And it's a little bit repulsive, but it's also just really, really deeply human. And the fact that in the end, she's sort of the hero of the story, despite not being a female character with masculine virtues in the way that you see in so many James Cameron movies, is actually really fascinating. I had not known that she won some award for bad acting in that, which makes no sense to me because she's so
good.
Did she
win a Razzie? Is that what I
believe so.
Well, this was one of the first Razzies, actually, I think, was when this came out, and it racked up a bunch of awards, which is just a reminder that the Razzies are dumb and pointless. I love this movie, and it is one of these. I take it back slightly about the Razzies, because this was like not an uncommon response to the film at the time. Mm-hmm. People were like, "This isn't scary." There's a great interview book with Clint Eastwood where they're talking about, you know, all sorts of stuff. It's like 30 years of interviews with Clint Eastwood, with this guy who worked for Rolling Stone. And there's a moment where he's like, "Yeah, we went to go see the Shining. That movie sucked. No scares, you know. There's one great moment with an axe and Scatman Crothers, but by then the thing's done, it's cooked." And I was like, well,
"There's the one great moment with the guy in the beaver costume."
Well, there's the mog. I think it's a man dog. It's not a beaver.
Whatever you want to call it, man.
But the movie sticks with you over the years, I have found, just because it is so perfectly shot and perfectly framed, and everything is dead center, and you've got those great steady cam shots and those great POV shots. I mean, like the shot where Jack enters room 237 and is like from his point of view in the way a like first person shooter would be or something, and it has this kind of immersive,
you actually see his hand reach in front of the camera to open the door, reminding you that it is literally a first person shot, not just sort of a vaguely
over the shoulder
perspective.
Right. So it is. It has all of these great little moments. It's got all of these great little touches. It has these things you can argue about. You know, why is Jack in that last photo? I love it, and I am glad that you enjoyed it. I'm glad that, you know, we told you it wasn't that. There's not that much violence. It's not, you know, a few little things.
This is a movie that brings us together in a lot of ways. It's probably worth talking about this in the context of Dr. Sleep, which I don't believe any of us have seen yet.
No.
But is coming out here in a couple of days, and is sort of being pitched as this weird hybrid sequel to both the book and the movie.
Have you read Dr. Sleep?
I have not read. I actually haven't read the original Shining book.
Oh, you should. You should. It's actually very good. But it is very different from the film. The Dr. Sleep is very much, very explicitly a sequel to the book The Shining. Like, Scatman Crothers' character is in the book. Obviously, he dies in the movie The Shining, so, you know.
Spoilers, Sonny.
But it is explicitly, like, kind of pitched as a sequel to, or it is written as a sequel to the book, which is very different from the film. And when I saw the first trailer for Dr. Sleep, and it had, you know, kind of all the visual cues from the film The Shining, I was kind of like, okay, I'm not sure. And then when it had the actual sound kick in, and I was just like, oh, this is ridiculous. This is, because I don't know. I'm curious to see how they square that circle. They are so different that I just don't quite know how Mike Flanagan puts those threads together.
Mike Flanagan is an interesting guy and sort of an odd. I don't know what to say odd. I did try about to say odd. He is. He's really not. He's like in some ways the opposite of Kubrick in his approach to his characters and his storytelling. For Mike Flanagan, everything is about sort of investigating in a deep way the emotional, like the nuanced emotional impact of what is going on, especially on sort of on families and on familial relationships. And he's really a kind of almost a, he's almost sort of soap operatic in the way he approaches his storytelling and his characters. I think he's more sophisticated than that, but he really is just sort of about the depths of drama and sort of the tears and right. And he's trying to make viewers feel that too. He's not just sort of staring from a distance. And so I'm curious to see how these movies end up kind of comparing with each other, given almost totally opposite directorial approaches. On the other hand, if you have seen The Haunting of Hill House, which is the Netflix series that he did based on the Shirley Jackson novel, the sixth episode of The Haunting of Hill House has just this incredible, is a single shot episode and is totally incredible the way it is staged and shot. And I mean, not just right, it's not just a technical exercise, it's really a very affecting episode of television. And so somebody who has done that and has that capability is actually, in another way, a kind of really apt choice to follow up Kubrick, who was one of the first people to use the Steadicam with The Shining. It was like one of the first five or six movies.
Well, and helped perfect some of the technology, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, yeah, to me, like, The Shining, to me, The Shining is just sort of great for how creepy it is, for, like, the way that it captures, first of all, like, just garden variety irritation, and then the way that garden variety kind of grumpiness and irritation, especially when you're trying to concentrate, like, everybody who writes for a living knows about this. Like, being interrupted is really irritating, and it can cause you to be kind of a jerk in ways that's not appropriate. But, like, what this movie does is sort of exaggerate and expand on that and sort of bring you into, like, no, that's actually, like, you take that far enough, it becomes a form of murderous madness. And so, Peter, there's, like, a feeling of that, like, you, like, I don't know, I, like,
so,
it's, like,
so, Peter, you agree with me, then, that this is a movie about a man whose family is trying to undermine him and destroy him.
No,
and that's what's scary.
This is a movie
that's
about,
scary about
this
it.
Is a movie about why writers need to be left alone to concentrate.
That's fair.
Otherwise,
we'll go crazy.
In cold, isolated places. And just, like, don't bother us and let us finish the book.
Let us wear our sweaters and write our stories. One other just quick assigned viewing recommendation. No, we didn't do it here, but I have seen it in the past and really love it, is Room 237.
Which is
Room
the documentary 236. About the theorists.
The documentary about the theorists who have obsessively watched it. It's a fascinating movie, even if you are not super into The Shining, because it is just a movie about obsession. Like, if you, like, take a step back from the actual subject matter and just watch it through the lens of, like, here are people who are, like, crazily deeply obsessed with something, it's really interesting. So
I guess I have a hard time resonating to that, just because it seems to defy the point of the movie, right? I mean, what is so powerful about The Shining is this sort of dreamlike quality, and trying to reduce that to logic and facts seems to take an enormous amount away from it.
Well, but that is, I think, part of the point, is that, like, you have this piece of art that is kind of endlessly interpretable. You can look at it in all sorts of different ways, and then people try to jam it into their, like, specific boxes. And I'm always interested to see people do that. So
anyway. I think it's a mistake to treat the whole movie that way. On the other hand, there are sort of points of meaning that you can pull out from little bits of it. There are particular choices that were made. There are sort of odd kind of ambiguities that pop up that aren't there just kind of accidentally or just because Kubrick thought it would look cool. Though there's also some of that. Kubrick notably screened Eraserhead for the cast when they were making this movie and said, that's the tone that I want. I want this sort of eerie, distanced, like, you're not quite sure what's real and what is not tone. And he pulls it off pretty masterfully.
Okay, that's it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple and elsewhere. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter, at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.